Hello, hello,
hello, hello, hello.
Hello.
Alrighty.
Yeah.
Hey, John, my name is Bill.
Hi, Bill. I know that.
Wonderful.
I know you well.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, I started listening right around Rosemary's Baby when you guys were doing those.
Okay.
And then I would listen to everything after that in 42 minutes also. So I know you guys.
Wonderful. I am recording right now. And just talk freely if there's anything you feel like you want to leave out of something that we put up for the public. Just let us know, and we'll chop it out.
Okie dokie.
So,
in case you want to shout out anything anti-Semitic or...
Nice, yeah. Well, Mel's coming by later, and yeah, Gibson.
I listened to that guy's like the thing that got recorded by his ex-wife or whatever that got played in court, and I like there's no way I could ever watch another Mel Gibson movie. I was so affected by it. Did you listen to that?
No, I didn't. No.
It's pretty hard to ever like. I mean, it was hard to begin with after the fucking Passion, whatever, and his whole deal. But like, I was like, I don't hate Mel Gibson. You know, I still don't hate him. I just feel bad for him. But it was just it was too much. He's like all shouting at her. It's kind of funny in a way, but it's just like he's just so. It just sounds like he's just so like cocaine, and he's just like, you can see your pussy from behind. Wow. Okay. He's like talking about her fake breasts, and he's like, "You look ridiculous. It looks fucking ridiculous."
You know what's weird is that I know two people quite well who have spent a good amount of time in one evening with Mel Gibson. So, like, an old guy I played baseball with, he went out to L.A. and he was at a bar, and Mel Gibson bummed a cigarette from him. And they spent the next, like, 2 hours drinking and smoking and said he was, like, the greatest guy on the planet. And then...
To smoke and drink with, sure. But I just wouldn't want to, like... It's just the way... To be a woman and be involved with him just sounds fucking... You know, that's not going to happen. But, I mean, I could... I have sympathy for them, you know? I was just like, wow. I mean, it was kind of entrapment the way she set it up. But trust me, if you listen to that, you might... be affected by your feelings on Mel Gibson. But, you know, you kick it, you play some pool, you know, whatever, you know, I'm sure he's great. Play some golf, sounds awesome.
He's an excellent golfer.
I bet. Yeah. Pebble Beach, huh? That's the thing. It's like that whole deal.
The way he carries his bag, though, it's very Jesus-like.
He does it like he's at the cross, like it's over his shoulders, and he's got his arms up and over it.
Absolutely. It's melodramatic, yeah. To say the least.
Really? That's amazing.
He just drags it along, and people whip him while he's...
Yeah, he's going to do a new movie with Tiger Woods. He's going to mash up... The Passion with Tiger Woods. It's going to be The Master and The Passion. So we'll see how it turns out.
So, John, you were telling me a minute ago before we were recording about what you do and what got you into sync. Would you mind repeating that?
All right. Well, I've been a carpenter for many years. A set carpenter working in theater and TV. So I did the Canadian Idol show. I did the Genies, the Geminis, the Junos, lots and lots of stuff. I used to be a mold maker. I used to work in a health food store. I'm not from Canada. I was born in the Azores, part of Portugal, so I speak Portuguese. As far as schooling goes, I went and I took early childhood education. That was about it as far as school and everything, just hard knocks. And then as far as sync, well, I've always been into sync, you know. Sort of sync is just like watching out, looking around, and seeing things that relate to other things and drawing conclusions, I guess, part of it. And when I was a little kid, I remember my Roman Catholic church, my mother told me at around Christmas time that we were going to go to the church and I was going to get to kiss baby Jesus' feet. And I was so excited. And, and then when I got there, there was like this statue. It was like a little icon, a little idol that they wanted me to kiss. And I'm like, that's not baby Jesus. So, you know, the world fell apart really young for me. And then I guess when I was in grade 7, I did a public speech in front of the school. It was on JFK and Lincoln and the similarities between their assassinations. And, like, you know, them having, like, the same vice president, well, same name anyways, and all kinds of things. Johnson. yeah, and then I ran into you guys through James Corbett. I know, Bill, you like him. Mm-hmm. Am I still on?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. I started listening right around when you guys were doing the stuff on Rosemary's Baby. And after that, I listened to everything backwards, or everything before that, and I listened to, you know what I mean? <That's> and then I listened to 42 Minutes, that whole spiel, and it's awesome. It's like, in some ways, it's changed my life, you know? Actually, since I've been asked to be on the show, a lot of things have changed. It's pretty crazy. Started kissing this new girl and stuff, and where things were very stagnant for the last years and years. So anyways, that's kind of me. Anything else? There's all a few other things that I have, like, written down and stuff, but that's about it for now.
That's what we do here on this show.
Yeah.
We change lives.
That's right.
We bring people together.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Dialogue, you know, this isn't like a this is just a conversation. We hang back and we drink coffee and we shoot the shit, and if people are interested, they listen, and if they're not, okay.
Yeah, that's fine.
So you said you're Portuguese.
Yep.
Have you ever looked into Santa Daime at all? Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, I do not. Tell me.
Santa Daime is the, like, ayahuascan church, right? So, and they're all, the founder is Portuguese, and they sing all these songs in Portuguese, and I've been invited multiple times, but I haven't gone, mainly because I don't speak Portuguese. And I'm like, well, if I spoke Portuguese, I'd probably be more apt to. I mean, I've experienced ayahuasca before, but I like the format of what they do. It's kind of intense, but
is it in California?
It's around. So they do it in California, but they do it elsewhere too. I don't know if they do it in Canada, but it would be worth going to wherever it's at because it's a big thing, life-changing experience, you know.
I bet.
But yeah, so South America, they do it, but, you know, I'm not taking any trips to South America anytime too soon.
Yeah, I'm actually not from, like, Portugal. I'm from the Azores, which is, you know, you guys know the Azores? It's an archipelago in the Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like 9 islands. I'm from the largest one. Pardon?
You speak Portuguese, though.
Yes, yeah. It's an autonomous region of Portugal.
Mm.
Yeah, I speak fluently. Yeah, the island's called St. Michael's that I'm from. And a really cool thing about it is there's two lakes inside of a crater in a volcano. And because of the different temperatures of the lakes, or because they used to be big crystals that melted, who knows, they have two different colors. One's turquoise and one's turquoise green, and the other one's turquoise blue. Very pretty.
Is that affected by the plant life that's around it, that's being reflected into the water?
It's the plant life water because the water is different temperatures in the each lake has a different temperature because one of them has a volcanic activity underneath it, so it's warmer.
Wow, that's awesome! So, yeah, on Hawaii, I spent some time in a crater lake on the Big Island near Hilo, and it was a trip. The color of the water, which I assumed was just from the plant life around it, was just like the water was the brightest water I'd ever seen. Like it was like fluorescent. You know, it tripped me out. I couldn't believe it. This hippie bought the whole mountain. He just lived there like in a yurt. And just like, if you go through and you talk to him, he's just like, no, go ahead, hang out. You're awesome guy. But, so you were saying that the incident being a child of kissing, like an idol of Jesus's feet and you're expecting the real Jesus, you happen to, after the fact, grow up to be a carpenter, which is pretty fitting for, you say Roman Catholic. Was that what I heard?
Yeah, definitely. And my name is actually, João Carlos, which is John Carlos, JC.
Mm.
Yeah. And, wow. It's a mountain. My island is a mountain and my mother's name. Well, I was born of Olympia. My mother's name is Olympia.
Wow. Trippy.
Wow. Yeah, I have 32 letters in my name. My name is João Carlos de Medeiros Pachuca Souza.
Wow. That's
a hell of a name.
Why, thank you.
32 pathways in your name there. So do you think that there's, I'm sure you've contemplated having literally the carpentry of the stage for Canadian Idol.
Yeah.
And you're telling me that it was the idol, the idol initially got you questioning, I guess, is what you're saying. Like, yeah, that's interesting.
At this point, I'd like to say this is exactly why I love Always Record. This is great. Anyways, yeah. And the other thing is on Canadian Idol, one thing that I did, not only was I the carpenter, but I was also like, I was with a more creative kind of carpenter on the show or on the crew. And so I got to do a lot of other things. Like one of the things we did was I got a grinder and scratched aluminum panels so that they had like just an abstract design on them. And I put my name in it. So, it's just a little bit of Masonic thing. You know, sometimes you never know who's doing it, right? It might just be a carpenter and not a Mason.
You subliminally snuck your name into the...
I could see it. You could see it if you looked real close. But, but like the way they do Canadian Idol, it's all like bang, 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 bang with the camera. So
right.
I didn't think anybody would really see it, but it's there.
Right. Exactly. That's the best kind. That's like sink wink to yourself. That's awesome.
Yeah. I often I would like think about it when I was doing shows, but not very often would I be able to do it so that it was nobody else would be able to see it. You know what I mean? Because you don't want the director going, "Hey, what's that?"
Uh-huh. Wow. That's pretty funny.
Yeah.
So the Canadian Idol, is that, it's affiliated in any direct way with American Idol? Do you ever have any crossover?
I think sometimes they'll have, like, guests from American Idol and stuff. The Canadian Idol's no longer on the air. It hasn't been for a few years.
They ran out of idols?
Yeah, they ran out of... It was too expensive. Because they not only do they have, like, the main show, but they went all over the country and stuff. And it just wasn't worth it. Because in Canada, it was one of the biggest shows around.
You know, it's funny because, like, in America, they had a show called Star Search in the 80s.
I remember that.
And, you know, the 80s are not well known for, I don't know, I guess that's a loaded statement. But, you know, the 80s are kind of received as a artistically thin decade. Take that for whatever it is. But, you know, Star Search seemed to be like the ultimate scraping the bottom of the barrel just like this minor league farming of talent. And
didn't Brad Pitt come out of Star Search?
I think there are some heavyweights that came out of Star Search. I think Sinbad. the greatest thing was that Dennis Miller lost to Sinbad in the Star Search finals for comics, and that's always kind of funny. But regardless, you know, the fact that American Idol and this Idol thing has gone global and has spread for quite a bit of time now. I think it's over 10 years now that they've had American Idol, and I don't know is that just a symptom of the globe now? You know, where, I don't know, it just seems like there's some parallel between what they're giving us on mainstream TV when they resort to shit like that. I don't know. It's the whole reality TV, which is easy. You don't have to script it. You just have to put people in a box and turn on the camera and then film enough hours so that you can edit it into something that you can call a product. But you don't have to spend time with real writers. You don't have to spend, you know, time actually constructing complex dramatic or comedic or, you know, it's a lazy, cheap product, really, in the end of the day.
Right. Of course, you could argue that the spontaneity of something that might come out of it, it's like live TV in that respect, even though it's not live, as far as I know. But it's got that quality to it that you don't know what's going to happen because it's so unscripted.
Yeah, it is live.
Oh, it is live. See, it's got that going on. You don't know what's going to happen with live TV. You know, it's like there's been incidents of things that have taken place. Like, I wish Bill O'Reilly was completely live because that would make it much more entertaining. Although maybe it is, but I doubt it because you guys seen the Bill O'Reilly freaks out behind the scenes. Yeah. See, so like, I would like to be watching a live program and just see something like that happen, and then. Like, you know, you'll probably never see it again in many cases, you know, although we live in an age when we have the internet and we can watch those things after the fact. But there was a time when shit like that would happen and you just never, like, I remember when I was a kid watching like all these politicians getting interviewed by students at Berkeley in like this big, like, gymnasium or whatever, or built, like, you know, whatever, a big building. And the students just like took it over and were like, 1, 2, 3, 4, we don't want your racist war. And we're like, just like, all the questions we've been given were made for us. Here's our real questions. Fucking whatever. It was like, this went on for like, you know, over an hour. And I remember as a kid, just like watching this during the Gulf War, just the expression on the politicians' faces was just terrified, you know, but it was live. Like, no one could have predicted that. And once something like that starts, you can't stop it because then everyone's tuned in, you know, like, but then after that, I never heard about that again. No one talked about that, you know.
I'm sure you can YouTube that.
So I'm waiting for that to happen on fucking Canadian Idol, even though apparently it's not on anymore. But like, where like the people go up and they're like, they told us to applause at a certain time and we're not going to, because, you know, it's hard to organize, but something could happen and you know that.
Shoot the applause sign, not the messenger.
But nothing does happen on American Idol and nothing does happen on Canadian Idol. Why is that?
Oof.
Because everybody involved is so invested in the chance to be, like, accepted. Like, everyone wants to be a star. If the light shines on them, they want to be remembered. I don't know. Something complicated. Is there something complicated about American Idol? I don't know.
Well, it's a fulfillment of ego, right? It's like you get on there and everybody's looking at you and you're the best. And you're going to be, and if you're not the best yet, you're going to be the best by the end of it. That's for sure. And that's what they keep on telling you when you're on the show, too.
Well, it's interesting that, you know, it's supposed to find people who have, you know, an element of talent or star talent, and American Idol puts them in a position to become stars. And, you know, they've had how many thousands of people go through their doors, and how many names can you remember that you identify as coming through the, you know, machine of American Idol? Maybe three or four.
So the ones that are put on the media.
Or the ones that just, everyone's given, you know, the spotlight in front of, you know, 50 million people. Everyone gets the album release. Everyone gets everything that is supposed to put you in a position to have a critical mass of people fall in love with you. But yet we have like three or four names that really have emerged from that engine. And, you know, you're talking about probably 20 million people who have walked through their doors. So the percentage is... I mean, it's a pretty amazing percentage. I mean, it should tell people that the system doesn't work, right?
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
Literally, every state of the union has sent thousands and thousands and thousands of people for the last 12 years through their doors, and there's like four people who've really made it.
Yeah.
But yet they keep going. There's that's... I think that's interesting.
Yeah, it is. It's like, and the child star thing is like the worst. Like,
that is the worst.
Dude, like how rare, like how many children, every parent thinks that their children is like...
Tortured children.
Yeah, man, what they put kids through, man, it's worse than Jesus camp for stardom. It's pretty crazy. I gotta just say here that I do not see Brad Pitt on Star Search in his IMDb. So it's funny. Every time I say IMDb, I think I am David Bowie or I am David Bowman. I am 42 is basically what you're saying when you say IMDb. Okay, so you did the carpentry for these shows, and you're... Share us a little bit about, you had mentioned to me in the email, some synchronicities you've been following recently.
Oh, yes. Actually, I was just about to, on the IBDM page, there's this actress in Toronto, her name is Michaela J. She's just very interesting. I'm just typing it, interesting, career. That syncs a lot. If you'll go to her IMDb page, you'll probably be able to help me out just by looking at the titles there.
What is her name again?
Her name is Michaela, M-I-K-E-L-A, okay. J-A-Y.
Is this the new girl that you've been kissing lately?
No.
Wait, I'm sorry. One more time. How did you spell that?
M-I-K.
Oh, M-I-K. Okay. Okay.
M-I-K-E-L-A. And J. J-A-Y.
Kind of like Michaela J. Fox.
Yeah. It's actually Michaela J. McHale, but her page is just Michaela J. So M-J-M. Anyways, it goes, the titles go, no night is too long. And then it's the L word, right? And her character, her name was Iris. And then it goes passageway. So L word could be like latent. And then passageway. And then crown heights, like, you know, when the baby's crowning. And then it goes bliss. And then it goes living with the dead. And then you're going to have to help me out with the drama and first wave. And then you go to the outer limits. And then there's murder with the Brotherhood of Murder. And they go into a strange world. And then in Millennium. In Millennium, I watched that. And in the first 5 minutes, she dies. And she dies from doing this heroin tainted with this, like, lizard DNA or something, where she starts turning into, like, a lizard. And then she commits suicide, jumps out a window, and lands on blackness. So she never actually dies. She just keeps on falling and falling and falling. And then you sort of see the pavement's wet. So there's like stars all the way around her. Yeah, it's so great. And then she was in Future Sport. And in Future Sport, you see her, like, basically there's, like, two big scenes with her. And in the first scene, she's in bed with a guy, and his name is Ramsey. And then the next time you see her, right at the end, or there's a few times you see her, but then right at the end, you see her again, and she's standing up against the wall, and behind her is, like, this blue stargate of lines radiating from around her as she walks up to the pharaoh.
She's a dead ringer for Mia Farrow. It's freaking.
That's funny. Yeah. She has been called Mia a few times.
That's like,
especially from Rosemary's
ringer,
Baby.
Man, absolutely.
She'll laugh when she hears that.
I'm looking here at the things, and then it says known for the corporation.
Yeah, she's the voice of the corporation.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, she's cool like that.
The shit that they put her in, like, this is, something. It's
she's very Andrea, what's his name? Jones. Andreas Jones-y, like.
So you're suggesting that, kind of like an Andreas Jones thing, that you've been kind of following her and you've seen her movies and you kind of noticed that there was a sort of a narrative or a thread building between all these little movies, kind of like in the classic, Jake Kotz kind of sense, where you track an actor through different films and something, you know, that whole phenomenon is sort of manifesting through her work.
Yes, exactly. I've been just trying to cut my teeth on the synchro mysticism thing, trying to be a high priest as you guys are.
Well, this is interesting because I figure this is a good opportunity to kind of walk through it a little bit. What was your first exposure to Michaela J?
My first exposure was meeting her as a friend of a friend working as a set carpenter. She was doing some music work with my friend Andrea. And then we just met, you know, once every couple of years or whatnot. And lately we've been sort of hanging around a bit. And she's a Facebook friend of mine too.
Okay. And so you met her as a carpenter on a set. And what was the set for?
Oh, no, I met her at work. She was at work. So she was at Mickwood Studios in the paint space.
And then did you start, had you seen her in movies before then, or did you just?
No, I hadn't. No, not that I knew, although I did watch, like, she was also in this show called Simon Says, which is The Outer Limits. She played Zoe, Life. And I remember seeing that show. And, oh, yes, and she was also in this show that I couldn't find to watch again. It was a TV show where she was she was living in a lesbian relationship with this other woman. And when I saw that, I went, hey, I know that girl. This is Michaela.
I like that she's Zoe in The Outer Limits. You're saying that episode had something to do with reptilian blood or something? What did you
No,
believe?
That was Millennium, where she was Alyssa.
Oh, that was okay. Okay. So she's Diane in the Millennium? Or Alyssa, they're the same.
Yeah, well, that's two different episodes. But the one that I was talking about was Alyssa. Yeah, Human Essence. In Siren, the one below Human Essence, she was she went to a psychiatrist, so she was a patient, and the show starts with the titles and stuff. And then there's an image of her hands, and it goes up to her face. And just as it's going up to her face, the title comes on, which is Siren, right? And then you don't see her for the rest of the show, but she's obviously the real Siren.
Uh-huh.
Because she had the title underneath her.
Huh. Wow, yeah, so, wow, that's interesting. I'm processing some of this.
Yeah.
So there was that, that Tarantino, was it Tarantino? No. The Killing Zoe, that was, mm-hmm. I think it was Tarantino.
I think he had something to do with that, yeah.
I think he produced it. He, yeah. His name to it.
Okay, and so you're saying that Zoe means life, literally? Is that?
Yeah, that's what I.
So
I
that figured. Was the meaning of that was like it's killing life, and so that's show you the real Paris or whatever, and so it's the strain on the thing. But Diane immediately, I think of Princess Diana, you know, mm-hmm. And I've been following a crazy. I mean, that's like a very meaty area for synchronicity. It's weird how tragedies work like that. But like they put that like Rosicrucian rose above the underpass where she got killed, and she's obviously "Goodbye, England's Rose" was like the number one selling song of all time, basically, of any single by Elton John. You know, like that was playing her funeral or whatever, and how she's taken as the rose. So then you have in Alice in Wonderland, the painting of the rose is red. And, you know, the potential next queen. And so this is her, their actual feud that lies, their energetics, that the old queen doesn't want to let go of her crown. And so she basically is like, you know, wants to keep her position of power and the whole off with her head thing. But that's a tangent. But anyway,
well, hold on.
I like the connection of Siren to that.
Well, it's not really a tangent because in Zoe, in Simon Says, that TV show, what it's about is it's about this man, his son died and he figures it was his fault and he wants to make his son again. So he's a robotics expert and he keeps on stealing parts from work. And he makes this new child that talks to him. And he had, like, just before the child died, he had downloaded the child's brain so he could put it into this robot. And Zoe is the one that convinces him that this is a bad thing.
Oh, far out.
Does
Zoe
turn out to be a robot?
The old man, actually, what happened in the end, he makes himself into a robot also. To escape the law because he killed the guy because the guy was going to find out about the kid and take away the kid. Actually, the guy was his boss that found out that he stole all the parts for the kid and he was going to take him back because it was his property. Outer Limits, cool show.
Yeah, those were the new ones. Yeah, they're pretty cool. Yeah, there's a number of Outer Limits I could talk about, but it wouldn't be as relevant necessarily. Yeah. Her the series of names like the Iris and the L word. Wow. Yeah.
It's good,
okay.
Eh?
So. Yeah. No, it's super good. Like it's like dropping a whole thing and then getting to go through it as quickly as possible. You know. I mean, Iris is that a Greek god? I look it up.
Yeah, she's the goddess of light, I think.
Right. Which is, I mean, where we obviously get the name for I, but personification of the rainbow and messenger of the god. Yeah, so that was something I came across at one point when I was tripping out on 2001 A Space Odyssey with a close-up on Dave Bowman's eye. Changing the different colors, and then the iris is literally the personification of the rainbow, and so there's kind of a, you know, over the rainbow thing happening expressed through. But okay, yeah, I like it. Crown Heights. That's perfect little expression of the crown chakra, right? That's good.
Yeah. And I like it right after passageway, right?
Mm-hmm.
So no light is no night is too long, and then I don't know about that one, but then you got the L word, which is later or latent, and then it just, you know, it hasn't gone through the passage, late going through the passageway, but eventually you get the Crown Heights, and then you get the bliss.
Right, or you could also take it as like the white rabbit is always late for his important date, but
nice.
it's also latent because it's always already. So he's never arriving because it's already happened, or that he's already there. It's like the present, right? Keep going, you're almost here. Keep going, you're almost here.
So the rabbit hole is an iris.
Totally, yeah.
I like that it says 14 titles right there.
Uh-huh.
And now I'm thinking of No Night Is Too Long, that, you know, when you're in that dark night of the soul, you know, that last stage trying to get that final piece of the puzzle, which can last, well, just ask anyone, that there's seemingly some sense of completion there that I'm picking up, but...
Yeah, well, there's 14 segments that surround the Rosicrucian cross, right? Which contains the Princess Diana's rose.
See, because I'm going from the first one or the last one, where Future Sport is Welcome to the Paradox. You know what I mean? That this is the mm-hmm. game that is what we have left to do in the future is resolving this paradox, which is the new millennium. And it's a strange world indeed. So you can kind of take this list of movies, you know, you can go up the tree or down the tree with this thing. One, you're kind mm-hmm. of being born, the other, you're going back in. I don't know what really to make of that just yet, but that does, I can see why this kind of triggered a lot of thoughts in your head.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it starts with no night is too long, and then it ends with the corporation.
Well, I'm kind of going from just the 14 titles, so the 14 pieces of Osiris that Isis, which is very close to Iris, is searching to put together to, you know, resurrect the dying god or the dead god. And
yeah, so he's reincorporating him, right?
Well, in the sense that you entered in No Night is Too Long, that you've kind of stepped in with No Night is Too Long.
Yeah.
And then when you finally get to the end of this list, you're going to go back up again.
That's true. And funnily enough, often when I was watching all these movies, I was watching them till 5, 6, 7 o'clock in the morning.
Interesting.
It's weird, too, because you have... the actress, right, with her 14 pieces, her 14 titles. And then you have Miscellaneous Crew,
yeah.
You have editor and you have self. And there's three in the crew, one in the editor, two in the self. And you could chew on that for a hell of
nice.
A long time. like the miscellaneous the miscellaneous crew, I don't know, that's kind of interesting there.
Hey, how does so IMDb connects to your Facebook automatically? Because I have all my friends on the side of the screen, but it's like John Fell Ryan is like the first guy. It's kind of funny. I don't know what that's about. So I like Andromeda as like the Andromeda strain. I've never seen the TV series Andromeda. In fact, yeah. I don't watch very many TV series at all. Yet it just so happens that she's in two of the ones that I felt like I wanted to watch more, Outer Limits and Millennium. Those both looked really good, but I watched like maybe four Outer Limits, and every one I watched, I was like, God, that was awesome. I mean, I watched like all of the old ones and Twilight Zones, but I didn't expect that the, new Outer Limits would be as good as they were. There's like, one about the wall with like, you know, how like you'll trip out on a stucco wall and see faces in it and stuff.
Yeah.
It was like, there was like somebody kept on seeing faces in the wall, but then it turned out that they were real and then they like moved and they're like people stuck in the wall. And then she gets pulled into the wall eventually. It's like they put her in an insane asylum or something and they're still there and it's fucking scary.
At 20. Yeah. In Andromeda, she was Colonel Yao, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, and she was the orphan. She was an orphan, and she lived with the fish people, people that had genetically modified themselves so they could live underwater. And normally those people didn't like the breathers, but the president adopted her as one of his children. So she was like an adopted child of the fish people, which is weird.
Yeah, that is weird. All Great Neptune's Ocean is
yeah.
what it's called.
Yeah, All Great so, Neptune's yeah. Ocean. Yeah, a horrible show, oh my God.
Yeah.
But she did really good in it.
Huh.
Yeah.
So she changed her name to Mikaela McHale.
McHale, yeah. She actually, yeah, she changed it to that, but she doesn't usually use the McHale. It was sort of, McHale was, somebody asked her to put another name in because it would have sounded better at one point way back when, and she put it in, but decided later that she didn't like it, so she just stopped using it. Something like that.
Huh. Because it is in all of these, but that's how it is in the credits, though.
Mm-hmm.
As Mikaela J. McHale. Yeah,
it's weird. Like, I think it's, well, I don't know, hold on.
Hey, can you Facebook her and get her on the phone? Can she jump in? Can she?
I can try, yeah.
How weird would that be?
Hold on, where the hell am I put my phone?
Hey, Mikaela, we've been talking about you for the last 40 minutes.
Well, I told her, I actually even asked her. I asked her if it was okay if I could talk to her about her on the show. Because I knew that if I was going to be putting a lot of hours into studying her career, I'd want her to approve it at least.
It's odd to have it so close to home in your situation.
Yes.
Yeah. It's one thing to actually, you know, delve into like a Mia Farrow. I'm never going to really bump up against her or whatever. But to actually know the person, that's what I think is so fascinating with Will Morgan and Andras Jones, how they were able to really kind of come together really nicely in the work that they did with his film work and really do a lot of really good videos with that. So,
yeah, I wish I would be able to do it. But one thing that I realized as I was studying this, cutting my teeth on synchromysticism, is I'm a carpenter. I'm not a synchromystic. And I think the synchronicity part plays a part in my life. And I really enjoy it because I think part of synchronicity is like when, like anything, you get two ideas. When you get two ideas that are separate and you bring them together in your head, like it's a joke. Somebody tells you a joke. It's two things. You bring them together and it gives you a boost of good hormones and good, you know, things inside your head. Synapses start snapping and that you get a good feeling, right? And that's part of synchromysticism, right? I think Alan has said that synchromysticism isn't about like joy in the end, right? Like it's not what's going to bring you joy. But I disagree a little bit with that because of that fact that whenever you bring two things together, which is part of it, makes you happy.
Well, it makes you happy. I think what to qualify his point is that was saying that people go through all kinds of twists and turns with where they don't get to choose where their rabbit holes lead, or maybe they do choose just on a level that's beyond their scope. You know, I mean, it's basically something bigger than yourself, and so if you're following something, it doesn't always lead to the rosiest places. Especially in one's process, you know, Jake would say that in the end, it leads to joy. It led to joy for him. But I think that there's something to Jake's, argument, and there's something to Alan's argument as well. It's just that, you know, there's no way to predict where synchronicity will lead. I mean, you're mentioning that this girl looks a lot like Mia Farrow, and like, where Mia Farrow's synchronicity leads is like pretty fucking heavy and hard to you know, not be like, wait a minute, that's fucked up.
Which is a great sync for me this morning because I just popped in The Exorcist for the first time in many years to watch this morning. And
Loaded.
Oh my fucking God. And the reason why I think it was interesting the fact that you mentioned, the first thing you mentioned when you got on the call was that the first Always Record show that you had listened to was The Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you bring up this actress who's a dead ringer for Mia Farrow. And Rosemary's Baby and Mia Farrow has been on my brain all morning because of The Exorcist and the character of Burke Dennings, to me, being a complete composite or supposed to represent Roman Polanski. And I wanted to ask David and Alan if he was able to join us, and you, if you had seen The Exorcist recently and if you had made that connection with if you know the character I'm talking about.
Last time I saw The Exorcist, I was like, I was very, very afraid. It was a long time ago.
David, had you ever made that connection?
So, no, I didn't make that connection. But one thing that I was just thinking about a lot was that you have the priest in there. It's Max von Sydow, right? Max von Sydow, one of his elite well-known roles, which is my favorite role that he's done, is the Steppenwolf. Hermann Hesse's Steppenwolf. He plays Harry Howler.
Really? And in so, in
yeah,
a movie?
Exactly. And so if you watch those two side by side, that's one to... If you want to find some interesting corresponding implications, that's a truly neat one. also, he's the devil in Needful Things, in Stephen King's Needful Things, which then it's a good sequence to watch in a row. Like, watch Steppenwolf, watch Exorcist, watch Needful Things, and watch The Shining, and the correspondences. something that I never noticed, and I need to look at it again. I could be totally mistaken, but I think the name of the character in the film of Rosemary's Baby, that comes across with the, as an anagram and she switches it, it's like Kesavets,
yes,
or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But that isn't that, so obviously like Roman Polanski, but then, I thought that was the fucking name of the guy who's acting in
that
John
movie. Cassavetes is her husband.
Cassavetes. Right, in real life, yeah.
It's slightly different, but it's almost like right there in front of your face. I mean, because it's this amalgam of Roman Polanski, a director, John Cassavetes, who's a really famous, but like independent kind of film director. He was kind of one of those Orson Welles dudes who would act in Hollywood movies to get money to finance his own films.
Yeah, and he was fucking... He had a bunch of weird fucking movies. I was going to get into this before I was going to talk about it. I wanted to look up some stuff and do some double-checking of things, but yeah... I was thinking about Rosemary's Baby for like half a day yesterday.
Well, it's interesting because The Exorcist seemingly is a film that was made because of the success of Rosemary's Baby. You know, when Rosemary's Baby was made at Paramount Studios, which was the last place studio in Hollywood. It was like the 11th, biggest or most profitable studio in Hollywood. It was the basement. So they were able to take a chance and make this very kind of seemingly controversial movie. And when it made millions, it kind of opened up the doors for all the other studios to take chances in those directions. So a movie like The Exorcist, which is as... I mean, there's really nothing too obscene in Rosemary's Baby. I mean, on the surface, to a child's eye, it's pretty damn conservative, right? I mean... There's some weirdness going on with the hallucinatory rape scene, but most of that is implied. I mean, you fill in the gaps of that scene with your mind more than anything. But The Exorcist, they don't really leave anything to the imagination, especially with the language. I mean, the language is insane to see a 12-year-old girl saying, don't touch my cunt, you fucking bastard. I mean, that was heavy, 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 especially because she was a good Catholic girl. So, for the fact that the director of the movie that Reagan's mom is starring in is this shrimpy little guy who seemingly looks like Roman Polanski. He's drunk at a party, and he's accusing the butler of being a Nazi. And, he's in Reagan's room, and they don't know, they can't say, but... It's implied that Reagan threw him out the window. You know, that And it's also implied, I think, on certain subtexts, which Rob Eger does a really good job of, is suggesting that the director, who is supposed to be Roman Polanski, has molested and drugged Reagan at a certain point in time in the past. Mm-hmm. It's a lot to go into if you haven't seen it, just recently, because to me it's pretty plain. But what does this say about, outside of the film itself? What did Roman Polanski do, right? Now, the final piece of the puzzle that I think seals it is the actor who's playing the director, Burke Dennings, the stand-in for Roman Polanski. He was in Roman Polanski's first film, Cul-de-Sac, and he had a part written for him specifically in The Fearless Vampire Killers. So in the first two Roman Polanski's movies, this guy stars in them. Then he goes into The Exorcist playing Roman Polanski, and he's dead the next year.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just an astounding thread of sync that I haven't really read elsewhere, but I'm sure it's been approached and discussed. But for me, what this is kind of speaking to is... what was the role of Rosemary's Baby for Roman Polanski? What it speaks to the larger themes that he was addressing, and the fact that wasn't his parents that were killed by Nazis, and he escaped from a Nazi prison camp. I'm pretty sure.
What's that? What was the last thing?
Polanski escaped from a Nazi prison camp, right? His parents were murdered in a prison camp?
I didn't think that it was a Nazi prison camp. I thought that it was, what was his history with, in Russia? He had to walk across, like, the Roman, I was typing in Roman as I was talking. He had to walk across the countryside through Russia as a small child, like, long fucking trek by himself to escape from some crazy shit. So,
like Ayn Rand.
Yeah. look up his youth there. I looked at it when we were looking into this, and it, whatever it was, blew me away, but my recollection is hazy. It's a weird guy. I was just looking up Clay Tanner. It's like the devil in Rosemary's Baby, who's only in it for like a second, that people say was Anton LaVey, yeah. Which is not true, I don't think. But
is he the guy in white?
He's the I thought he was the guy with the scaly hands that's like caressing her in that scene. The Nazis invaded. Okay, you found it.
Oh, yeah.
You want to read it?
The Nazis invaded the Jewish ghetto where Polanski lived with his parents when he was 6 years old, and his father and a Polish policeman helped him escape before both of his parents were sent to concentration camps. So pretty fucking traumatic right there. His mother died at Auschwitz, but his father survived at a different camp. He made it through World War II by hiding with Catholic peasant families. This did not prevent him from being once used for target practice by the Nazis and from being seriously injured in a war-related explosion. So, whole thing is his second movie is The Fearless Vampire Killers. And he casts a specific role for this guy who later plays a drunken Roman Polanski in The Exorcist. And, I mean, that's just sinky as fuck.
Yeah, that's more than I realized. I didn't realize all of that. And but there's more of the story I thought. Another tip. I was trying to find Clay Tanner, the devil in Rosemary's Baby, is in The Outer Limits. And I was going to look up the episode before. I mean, he's in a lot of things. Hawaii 5-0. I don't know what to make of that. it's weird. Like, why would they? I don't know. Like, they could have been. anybody. I mean, all you see is his hands, right?
Well, you know how the
it's
use
like,
of
they don't
like
really know you, the guy, it's somebody in clay in like a outfit. Who's... Walt Disney's The Wonderful World of Color in 1973
is the year that this guy died. This actor.
Yeah, he's uncredited in Rosemary's Baby, even though he's fucking devil in it. That's weird. No wonder everyone puts it on Anton LaVey. The fucking character is uncredited. Oh, Outer Limits in 1963. Oh, shit. That's the other Outer Limits. Oh, but it doesn't... It won't show me which episode was his. Damn. Oh, wait a minute. Maybe it is. Oh, no, it doesn't. I just want to find out which episode of Outer Limits fucking Clay Tanner was in. It's not showing me. Second. Oh, here it is. Okay, it does have it. Sorry, I'm with my phone. A secret group of scientists decide to surgically alter one of their members into an alien in order to convince the world that an alien invasion is imminent. They hope that... They hope that such a threat will force all governments to make peace with one another. However, such a complex plan has many vulnerabilities, including the wife of the volunteer. That's pretty awesome if you look at the idea that of Rosemary's Baby is being a moon child, and then Iowa's connection with the fact that Roman Cassavetes or whatever is supposed to be Crowley.
The first
that he's contacting the alien intelligence, and then it just so happens that the devil is... I wonder which character is his.
Well, the first line that the drunken Polanski says at the party in The Exorcist, when we're first introduced to him, is, "Somebody put an alien pubic hair in my drink." And then the next thing, it goes to a conversation of an astronaut talking about the Mercury and the Gemini missions, which is bizarre, to say the least. But you get that sort of, you have a movie about the devil, right? But then you have the director who's seeing Nazis and aliens. It's just such a weak little passing comment to the average moviegoer, seemingly. But when frozen and really looked upon, it just explodes into this bigger narrative. I mean, unbelievable. That's not a throwaway line. There's an alien pubic hair in my drink. I mean, just saying there's a pubic hair in my drink is weird, but to make it an alien pubic hair.
Yeah, what makes an alien pubic hair an alien pubic hair? Was the pubic hair green? Like, what's going on here?
Has he seen alien pubic hair before?
Well, alien doesn't necessarily mean extraterrestrial.
True, but, you know, that's a lot of...
That's true.
That's true. You gotta leave room for that.
I mean, in Poland, they considered the Jews aliens.
Really?
Well, yeah, because they showed up there with nothing and then, you know, made something for themselves.
Well, I get what you're saying.
Hey, you know what I'd like to talk about? Refrigerators. Because when you guys were talking with, what's his name, Alexander, the basketball player... a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
Joe Alexander.
You're discussing refrigerators in like Back to the Future and stuff and how they could be time machines.
Yeah, Indiana Jones.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I was wondering if you guys were like leaving out the obvious, because like to me a refrigerator is obviously a time machine. You put food in it and it slows down time for the food.
Totally.
You know?
Yeah, that was the idea with comparing the refrigerator in Indiana Jones and the fact that in Planet of the Apes they're frozen, right? And the lake that they die in when his crew drowns already frozen, but Charlton Heston, Moses, survives, you know, and his crew dies. That lake was the same lake that's shown in the sequence of 2001: A Space Odyssey of Jupiter and Beyond the Infinite, which is basically moving through a wormhole, which is what they move through, supposedly in Planet of the Apes. And so, but the fact that in that film in 2001, you have the frozen crew, and then here you have the frozen crew in Planet of the Apes, and, that's basically to freeze one for, that is a way to move through, to fold space. But then at the same time, you have that it was time traveling in Planet of the Apes. So, I mean, he basically time traveled. So that's interesting.
Yeah. You know, in the astronauts on the ship in 2001, you know, they are murdered, but are they thawed out? Are they unfrozen? I mean, that's a small technical point, but it wasn't as if the cryogenic process stopped. It was just like the sustenance was taken away, right? I mean, they didn't turn off the refrigeration. They just removed that's kind of reaching, I guess.
I saw this thing 2 days ago where this guy was doing a critique of, or not a critique, just an explanation of the film. And he was saying how at one point Kubrick shows this display panel that shows that there's a backup for those people that are in the cryogenic chambers. So they might not be dead, and it might all be a dream.
Right. Or that the crew is actually waking up afterwards, and they just don't show it to you. They just cut ahead after Hal is taken, and that part of the mission is for them to still send him out there in the pod. You know, that the rest of the crew is actually still there. I mean, there's all these things that are open possibilities, and it's them seem to be left open purposefully.
That's what makes it good. Yeah.
Totally. Huh.
Another thing that I've done that's kind of sinky is I'm JC, right? And I used to be Johnny Oakseed, because when I was a mold maker, I used to make these plastic trees. They're oak trees, and they're 6 feet tall, and like you couldn't put your arms around them. And I used to travel all over Canada and the United States planting oak trees all over malls, plastic oak trees.
I love that.
Yeah, I've been everywhere from Roanoke, Virginia to Salt Lake City, Utah, where I saw the Mormon Tubercular Choir.
That's a great little with the tuberculosis freak out going on right now. I love that.
Yeah, yeah, I got that from Harry Chapin. The singer.
Alan just came online, you guys.
Oh, wicked.
Alan on in a second. That'll be fun. So maybe I just trying to have the call right now.